Scotch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning, Part 1, Bird Bark, Barcelona, Foundation Season 2, The Outlaws, and Star Wars, the radio drama. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Evil Dead Rise on 4K. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Let's quickly hit the box office before we start talking about the bigger news of the week. Insidious: The Red Door beat Indiana Jones 5. I'm not surprised, because Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny came in a little bit soft that first weekend. It also spreads itself out over 4th of July week. And then Insidious: The Red Door, these little horror movies, if you release them at the right time and you spread it out, horror does still do well at the box office. As we saw with, like, Evil Dead, and we saw that with Smile, and we saw that with The Black Phone, and we saw that with Scream earlier this year. So it's not a big surprise. But then you have these big movies like Indiana Jones 5 or The Flash or Fast X that cost $300 million to make. Of course, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 is also a $300 million movie, or almost. So they're really setting themselves up to fail when they cost that much, because there's so much money they have to make up in return. So we'll see how well these movies do with this $300 million budget. Talk to me next week after the Mission Impossible returns come in. But the big news for the week is the actors have gone on strike. The writers have been on strike for months, and now the actors are on strike. SAG-AFTRA have not come to an agreement with the AMPTP, which is the organization that does the producing, that represents the producers. And this is the first time we've had a double strike since 1960, 63 years ago. That's the last time that both the actors and the writers struck at the same time. And Ronald Reagan was the president of the Screen Actors Guild at the time. So you talk about times changing. Let's just say Reagan's treatment of unions had changed quite a bit from the 60s into the 80s. But that's neither here nor there. That's just sort of like a more of a historic note, that a lot of people and a lot of actors weren't even alive, or certainly weren't aware or working at the time that this happened last. Now, when it comes to the writers were striking mostly about residuals and payment. And that's usually what these strikes are about. I mean, it's a money issue. That's usually what strikes happen. And this is going to just derail a whole bunch of productions in many different ways, because now that you can't have actors in there, you can't do pre-production because you can't write. You can't do production because you don't have actors in front of the screen. And there's a lot of post-production that's going to be messed up because you can't do rewrites and reshoots. And on top of it, with the actors, because those are the stars, those are the faces you recognize, you can't promote. So all this stuff you've been seeing about Barbie and Oppenheimer, that stuff comes to an end now, because they can't even tweet about it, the actors themselves. And getting traction for a release through your social media is a big deal now. On top of it, as you move forward, we're going to have a bunch of festivals that stars aren't going to be able to go to, and they can't promote them. They can't go on podcasts. So that's going to disrupt that level of it in terms of the promotion of these things. So a lot of productions are going to suffer, but that's how strikes work. I mean, if you struck when things were convenient, it doesn't do its purpose. Now, the other thing, in addition to residuals and payments, the big thing for the actors is AI, artificial intelligence, being used to replace background actors. Because you got to realize, these strikes, this strike in particular, the strike that just started for the actors, this is not for Tom Cruise or Matt Damon. This isn't even for, like, Fran Drescher, who's the president of SAG. That's not who this strike is for. This strike is for the average working actor. And the only 13% of actors in SAG make enough money, that, like, $26,000 threshold, to actually get health insurance. So a lot of these working actors are making less than $30, sometimes less than $20,000 a year. This is for them. And AI is a big deal because, you know, writing, it's an issue with the writers, but it's a big issue with the actors. I spent some time on Twitter to some of the actors. John Cusack has a lot of really interesting stuff he's saying on Twitter. But there's also other people talking about the fact that they're scanning in extras. They're scanning in people into the computer who are nobodies right now. And every actor, people like Matt Damon or John Cusack, they were nobodies at one point, and they did anything to get on a set. And they're scanning people in and then using that image in perpetuity, and they can just create background, and they don't have to pay background actors. And there are people who make their entire sort of either living or supplementary income being background actors. That's how the industry works. Because for as much as people think, oh, it's the actors, it's the big names, even Mission Impossible, which is coming out this week. How many people can you name who's an actor in Mission Impossible? Five? You know, Tom Cruise, Haley Atwell, Simon Pegg, Rebecca Ferguson, Ving Rhames. You got these names that you can name, maybe 10, maybe 12 if you're well known in the movies. Do you know how many credited screen actors are in that movie? 75. 75 actors and 26 more that don't actually get screen credit, but are a significant paid portion of the acting budget. That's who this strike is for. It's for those below the line people, because that's who it's going to impact the most, not just with residuals and money, but with the fact that you're carving out their job for people who just, their job is to populate a movie set. I'd be curious to see how long this lasts, because this is essentially shutting down Hollywood. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer I want to talk about is Napoleon, which comes to theaters on November 22nd. Everyone
around is... What is this costume you have on?
This is my uniform. Everyone so
near. What is your name?
Napoleon.
Has the course of my life just changed?
I'm destined for greatness. But those in power will only see me as a sword.
I suggest you take the throne
as a king.
I'm the first to admit when I make a mistake. I simply never do.
One of the things I can't stand about trailers nowadays, and I added this in there because I wanted to get an authentic feel of what the trailer was like, is the idiocy of taking contemporary and times annoying music and putting it into the trailer. And then, of course, you see, I guarantee you, you're not going to have that song that's playing in the trailer play anywhere in the Napoleon soundtrack. It's going to be standard orchestral scoring. This looks like it's going to be a nice epic action film. It's a very Ridley Scott type movie. It looks still murky and hard to watch at times because that's how he's been shooting his movies for the last 10 years. And I'm curious to see this. I just hope this thing isn't like 3 or 4 hours long. The next one I want to talk about is Wonka, which comes to theaters on December 15th.
Many people have come here to sell chocolate. They've all been crushed by the chocolate cartel. You can't get a shop without selling chocolate, and you can't sell chocolate without a shop.
I know things haven't been easy for you. They're gonna get better.
You promise?
Pinky promise. That's the most solemn vow there is.
Where do we start?
My name is Willy Wonka.
He's good. Too good.
Now here's one where I'm a little more torn because I just am not feeling Timothy Chalamet in this. First of all, you know, I'm not a Chalamaniac. I do not like him as an actor. I mean, he's fine and he can act, but I do not think he's God's gift to acting. And he comes across as very inauthentic in this movie. I mean, Gene Wilder was amazing as Willy Wonka. And I thought Johnny Depp did a really good job making the role his own when he did the Tim Burton movie. But this one, I just don't feel it from Timothy Chalamet at all. But it's the guy who directed Paddington. And Paddington's such a great movie. And if only we could have a CGI bear instead of Timothy Chalamet in this film, I would probably like it better. Anyways, coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Bird Box, Barcelona, and the Outlaws. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews. And this is going to be kind of the Netflix segment. I know it's all bad to talk about studios now because of the strikes is plural going on. But I was on vacation for the last couple of weeks, so I was taking an Alaskan cruise. It was my anniversary, so my wife and I got out of Dodge, so to speak. First one is new, actually, this week. And that is Bird Box Barcelona, set during a concurrent time as Bird Box. A Spanish father struggles to make sense of an invasion by creatures that compel people to commit grisly suicide when they are seen.
Those things, they take our fears and they twist them.
Now, an alarming spread of incidents into Europe.
Thousands of cases in Spain.
These creatures are changing.
I remember when Bird Box came out, it kind of was one of those early Netflix phenomenon. And I remember asking the marketing people a year or two later doing a junket with them. I said, did you know Bird Box was going to be as big as it was? And they're like, no, we had no idea. So it kind of was the first one that when they realized, oh, you get some big names because you had Sandra Bullock in the original Bird Box. This one, it's not a sequel. It's a concurrent story. So it's essentially the story of some people in Barcelona, whereas the first movie was, I'm assuming, somewhere in Southern California because everything is. But this one, it's a Spanish language English. It's going to default to the dubbed English version. But, I mean, you can probably go back and change your settings to listen to the original Spanish language, because there is some character, there's one character that speaks German, one character who speaks English, but it takes place about the same time. Now, if you remember from the original Bird Box, it's these creatures, they don't know where they come from, you can't see them, but when people witness them, they commit suicide, and that's sort of this weird invasion. It's sort of like the sight version of A Quiet Place, which those were sound creatures. This one's more visual. And the original Bird Box I really liked. I think it was perfect, but I enjoyed it for what it was. This one, it's clunkier. I will say that. It has some neat stuff in there, but it has elements to it that feel, I don't want to say cheaper, but it just feels like it's a little lower rent. But hidden in there, you know, as even though the movie is not as hard hitting, and I don't think it's as structurally soundly put together as the original Bird Box was, it deals with some kind of interesting stuff. Because the whole point is there's these characters in the Bird Box movies that do see the creatures, but don't commit suicide. It almost becomes zealots and then try and get other people to see them and then commit suicide. You actually had a character like that in the original Bird Box. So it deals with that, but it deals with it a little more personal and looking into why people do that and what is actually going on. So it's giving you a little bit more insight. It's revealing some more stuff about this invasion that's going on. It doesn't give you too many answers, but it actually opens up for some interesting concepts. And that's, I think, what saves the movie. Otherwise, it's just your standard people wandering around trying to survive some sort of apocalyptic nightmare. But, it has that little extra something in there that makes it more interesting in a lot of ways because you're delving into questioning what actually is going on, and it's not just trying to run against adversity. So, I mean, it's imperfect and it's silly at times, but the ideas behind it bring some new textures to the Bird Box concept. So I'm going to say, and be nice here, that it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about another movie from Netflix, and this is The Outlaws. It actually came out last week, and like I said, I was gone. Anyways, in The Outlaws, Adam Devine plays a mild-mannered bank manager who discovers his soon-to-be in-laws are notorious international criminals.
My parents just emailed that they're coming to our wedding.
Oh, I get to meet your parents finally.
Are you psyched? You're not psyched.
See,
You deserve something better than that pasty little goober.
Dad, just give him a chance.
What does a bank manager do?
I manage all the security.
I think your parents robbed my bank.
You can't be serious.
Does the name the Ghost Bandits mean anything to you?
Most notorious bank robbers in American history.
This is kind of a mixture of a bunch of things. It's a Happy Madison production, so it's got Adam Sandler's production company behind it. And Adam Devine also, he's got a couple of the people from the Workaholic show that he used to be on. So it has these old callbacks to what some of the people have done before. And it's R-rated simply more for language than anything else. Not that it's aiming for a PG-13 audience, but it feels like it could be a romantic comedy, but it really isn't. It's much more of Adam Devine's movie and how he's interacting with his potential in-laws, which are played by Pierce Brosnan and Ellen Barkin. And his fiance is played by Nina Dobrev, who what's interesting is she's kind of making a bit of a career for herself now that she's well past the Vampire Diaries and into her 30s. She's playing the love interest to a schlubby guy because she was in that holiday movie a year or two ago. And some of the comedy is really good. Adam Devine, he's a very funny guy. He does some very funny stuff. And he plays the schlub very, very well. And both Ellen Barkin and Pierce Brosnan, as these agents of chaos that come into his life, they're pretty good at what they do. I mean, it's good performances. The script isn't terribly well-formed. It feels a little half-baked. It feels a little clunky at times. It doesn't always fit together. And, not every joke lands. There is some stuff in there that's very, very funny. There are some scenes that are outrageous and over the top and can be pretty clever at times. But there's also some stuff that just lands very flat. Not every joke seems worked out. It seems like this could have baked a little bit longer. Ironically saying that without being a drug movie, but you know, it's hit or miss with some of the broad comedy moments, but you know, it's passable fish out of water, light comedy for background noise. You know, like if you want something just in the background, or if you're like, it's a Friday night and you want something mindless to watch, it's not a great movie, but it's watchable. And I know that sounds so dismissive of a film, but sometimes that's what you want. I don't always want something heavy or overpowering. And these kind of movies do well on Netflix. They're the kind of films that when you're just looking for something and you want to watch it, if you fall asleep in the middle of it, the world's not going to end. You know, there's a value to this stuff. This is the kind of thing that would have been released in theaters and may have made $20, $30 million. But these are the things that are going heavily to streaming. But that's okay. You know, sometimes that's what you need. I'm going to be nice. It's sort of like Bird Box Barcelona. I'm going to be nice and say it kind of rocks, even though I'll fully admit it's not great.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1, and Foundation Season 2. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about the big one this week, and that is Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. When a new AI system threatens global stability, Ethan Hunt and his team desperately try to get it under control.
Your days of fighting for the so-called greater good are over. This is our chance. Control the truth, the concepts of right and wrong for everyone for centuries to come. You're fighting to save an ideal that doesn't exist. Never did. You need to pick a side.
I'm not one of those people who loves the Mission Impossible movies. I mean, I know people who rewatch all of them every time a new one comes out. I don't have time in my life for that. I've liked some of them. I've loved others. never a huge fan of the first one. I actually recall seeing the second one and really enjoying it, but I haven't watched it in 20 years. Then I thought 3 through, well, now 7 have been pretty good. I think they've raised up in quality as they've gone on, and they've become their own thing. Ultimately, the Mission Impossible movies have become the American James Bond films, because there are scenes in here that are almost indistinguishable from No Time to Die, which is the latest James Bond movie. I mean, you could almost cut some of these scenes together, and aside from the fact that the car would change and the people in the car would change, you could be in the same movie. Unlike something like Fast X this summer, which has a weirdly similar story. And they have a very similar chase scene through the streets of a European city. But the big difference between something like the Fast movies and the Mission Impossible movies is the Fast movies use CGI, and everything's absurd in these movies. We know that anyways. But there's real stunts taking place in the Mission Impossible movies, and there's much more trickery going on in the Fast and Furious films. And I'm not saying that everything has to be done practically, but there's a quality that Tom Cruise demands when he makes these films. And I'm not a huge Tom Cruise fan. I mean, for everybody who say, oh my God, he's saving cinema. Where were you when Jack Reacher came out, or The Mummy? But I respect the heck out of him for doing these practical stunts. And Dead Reckoning is loaded with these kind of things. It is non-stop action. Really, it is. There's not much of a story there. And most of the character moments and dialogue do nothing but serve the action. I mean, the story and the characters are kind of a delivery method for the action and stunt sequences. And it's a 2-hour and 43-minute movie, so it's long. And normally, I'd roll my eyes at something like that. You know, even something like John Wick 4, which was a great movie, there are points where I'm like, oh, okay, can we move it forward a little bit? I did not feel that we were marking time in Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. I mean, it takes a half hour to get to the opening title sequence. And that's, again, where it feels like a James Bond movie, where it has all this setup, then you have this big title sequence, and then you have the rest of the film. So it's a well-done movie, and you see some of the same familiar faces coming back. You got Rebecca Ferguson back. You've got Ving Rhames and Simon Pegg as a support team. You've got Vanessa Kirby showing up again. And you've got some new people. Hayley Atwell's fantastic in this movie. I mean, she's arguably better than Tom Cruise. I mean, I would prefer to look at her. Tom Cruise, what's interesting, I just saw an article today where it's talking about how they talked about were they going to de-age him and do an older sequence. And I'm like, I don't know. I think they did some digital trickery with his face, because he doesn't look as lumpy as he does on the red carpet. You look at some of these shots and you're like, that looks too young for Tom Cruise. And I know he's sort of a vampire and doesn't age, but like, there was a shot in Top Gun Maverick where he was wearing his helmet and I didn't even recognize him as Tom Cruise, because he's gotten old. He's getting wrinkled, and they've really smoothed some of that out. So I think there was some digital trickery, but still the purpose of this movie is a big summer action movie, and the set pieces are fantastic. It is a really, really strong action film. It's exciting and it's thrilling. It pushes all the buttons you want to have pushed for a Mission Impossible movie. It's the 7th one. There's going to be an 8th one, because they got that part 2. So don't go in expecting everything to wrap up completely, because it's part 1's right there in the title. You know that you're getting a part 2. But I enjoyed it. I really did. I mean, it's top-notch action, hides the whisper-thin plot for a great summer action thrill ride. It's what you want this time. Is it going to make as much money as Top Gun Maverick? Probably not. That one kind of hit at the right moment and clicked with different audiences, but I think this one's going to have legs for the rest of the summer. I'm going to say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Foundation Season 2. This is on Apple TV Plus. With the Foundation starting to crumble, it's up to the digital ghost of Harry Seldon and other psycho historians to build a second foundation to save the galaxy from decline.
This is even bigger than the last crisis.
An empire breathes respect. It requires it for its life.
The Foundation is a threat to me.
I will look at them in the eye and reclaim what is ours.
for all of us to survive, we have to face them.
We need to be in the fight.
It's time you and I had a reckoning.
I don't know. I mean, I hear a lot of people loving the Foundation series. And I even had a conversation with my cousin when I was on vacation. And he was like, oh, have you watched Foundation? I'm like, yeah. And if you recall my response to the original series, season one of Foundation, I was really kind of disappointed in it because it strays so far from what Asimov wrote in his books. I mean, to the point that it puts stuff in there that Asimov would have never put in his books. It has way too much human emotion, weirdly enough. It has way too much sex. And I'm not a prude, but Asimov's books were not about sex. My father was a huge Foundation fan. He was a huge fan of Asimov. He passed away right around when they dropped the trailer for this. I never showed it to him because I'm like, I knew he wasn't going to make it to when the series came out. And I didn't even want him to know that they were making a Foundation series. And I'm kind of glad that he never saw it because it strays so much from Asimov's original vision. His stuff was very rigid and very much into science and math and how math dictates history. And the general sort of like more organic foibles of human nature aren't really dealt with in his books. I get that they're adding more to it because they want to make it more mainstream. And I was reading an interview with David S. Goyer, who directed and who runs the show. And he was saying stuff like, well, we had to add some sex and we had to add some action. And I'm like, well, that's not what Asimov wasn't a whiz-bang action guy. Asimov was cerebral. And yeah, this has a cerebral science fiction feel to it, but it also feels at times very soap opera-ish, especially when you're dealing with the Emperor. I think this new season has promise. I've only watched a couple episodes, but it still feels like it's shackled by David S. Goyer trying to make something from Isaac Asimov into something that's not Isaac Asimov. It's sort of like the iRobot movie with Will Smith that came out about 20 years ago. It's based on an Asimov book, but by making it a Will Smith action movie, all the stuff that made it a Will Smith action movie kind of soiled the Asimov elements. And they sort of betray him. And I feel they do that. They betray Asimov's memory with even this version of Foundation. So, you know, I mean, it suffers from the same convoluted diversions from Asimov's classic books, but it still presents an intriguing, though derivative, piece of cerebral science fiction. I mean, it's interesting, and if I could remove myself from my attachment to Isaac Asimov's original writing, I would probably like it more. But that's just me. So I'm going to be nice. Like, if I can give Bird Box Barcelona a Kind of Rocks, I think I can give Foundation Season 2 a Kind of Rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about the Star Wars radio drama and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Evil Dead Rise in 4K. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the reviews, and I'm going to go down a different path here. There's something I've been wanting to talk about for a while, and I think this is a perfect time to do it. It's a vintage piece. It's something I dug up a while ago. It's the Star Wars radio drama, which was produced back, it was either right before Empire Strikes Back came out in 1980 or right after it, and they did all three movies. NPR produced these high-end radio dramas based on the blockbuster motion picture.
This is Mark Hamill. Once again, I play the role of Luke Skywalker, this time in the only radio production of Star Wars.
We're going down that trench full throttle.
Right with you, boss. Luke, at this speed, will you be able to pull out in time after you fire?
It'll be just like Beggar's Canyon back home, Biggs. Watch yourselves. Increase speed, full throttle.
We're right behind you.
R2, that stabilizer's broken loose again. See if you can't lock it down.
Yeah. because I found these on the Internet Archive. You could find the original files of these, and they're broken down. I think there's something like 11 episodes for Star Wars. And Empire Strikes Back, there's like 8, and then I think there's 6 for Return of the Jedi. So this was done early in Star Wars fandom. And so back then, you have to remember, back then there was just Star Wars. And maybe the Star Wars Holiday Special, if you remember that nonsense going on. But ultimately, Star Wars was just a movie back then, back in the late 70s. And I remember when this aired, because I remember my dad turned on the radio. It was like on a Saturday or Sunday morning, and I heard it on the radio, and I wanted to listen to it, and he kind of poo-pooed it, because he's like, it's all broken up. You know, he wasn't interested in it, but I wanted to hear it. But you could only hear it because it was the way broadcast worked. Is you only hear it when it came out. And we didn't have our radio permanently tuned to NPR or anything. So I listened to one or two episodes, and I loved it because I was a Star Wars kid. But I'd never listened to it in its entirety. And I found these. And so it's like 11 episodes. So it's like a four-hour version of the movie. So one of the things that's fascinating about it, first of all, is they give a lot more backstory. They, I think, go from Lucas's original script, which is much more detailed, and it has a lot more to it, especially in the introductions. There are deleted scenes from Star Wars, the original Star Wars, where Luke's dealing with his friends back on Tatooine, where he's called Wormy, and there's like a girl and two guys. One of them's Biggs, who shows up later in the movie. And you never understand when you watch the film what the big deal is with Biggs, because he's edited out of all the earlier scenes and he just shows up at the end. And so like when he gets killed in the Death Star raid, you're like, why does he care? But it's a big deal. But they have all that. It takes like 3 episodes to actually get to the droids shooting off of Princess Leia's cruiser as it's getting abducted by the Star Destroyer. So it gives you a little bit more in depth. It gives you like a little more background. It takes a little bit more time because it's a radio drama. You can deal with the characters, and that's the real richness of it. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Empire Strikes Back and the Return of the Jedi radio dramas are shorter, is because those were more streamlined and they knew what they were making as movies, whereas when they first made Star Wars off the original script from George Lucas, they went through some iterations. It went through re-edits and changes, and they didn't know it was going to become the phenomenon that it was. There's another thing in there. There's a really interesting part in there that makes a lot of sense. Princess Leia takes R2-D2 and puts the Death Star plans in him, and she disables all his safety protocols. So it makes sense why R2-D2, through the rest of the entire series, kind of acts as a sociopath, because he has no safety protocols. And he's kind of free to operate who he is. They never reset them. She disables them all and says it's all about getting these plans to Obi-Wan Kenobi. And that's why he's so single-minded and at times reckless. And that really makes sense. It actually enriches some of these characters. And they deal with Princess Leia's family as well, with her back on Alderaan. And so there's this richness to it that's great. Like I said, it's about 25 minutes each episode. And you really get a holistic look at what Star Wars was in Lucas's mind before he made the movie. I found this thing to be absolutely fantastic. It's been really neat to listen to, especially after, 50 years of Star Wars almost. So I fully recommend it. Go back and check it out. You can find it on Internet Archive. You can find the episodes on YouTube. Just search Star Wars Radio Drama. They're available out there, and you can usually find them without having to pay for them too. Because they're from National Public Radio. So I'm going to say these things totally rock. Check it out, the Star Wars radio dramas.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on Evil Dead Rise on 4K. A fractured family is trapped in a high-rise during a power outage while demons try to kill them.
It's me. Don't let it take my babies.
This evil.
evil creates terror through total chaos. All you can do is run.
I'm getting this out of here.
You'd be a good mom someday, Honeybath.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, you know how to lie to kids.
Mom?
Mommy's with the maggots now.
This did much better than people expected. It was one of those, and I wouldn't call it a surprise hit, because we had been having horror do quite well over the last couple of years, even going back into the pandemic. When things were shut down, horror did quite well. And horror's a consistently well-received genre in theaters. And I think that's because there's a certain level of group therapy that you go through when you watch these things. And I mentioned them earlier, stuff like Smile and The Black Phone and Barbarian and even Scream, the new Scream movie, to a degree. These movies tend to do well in theaters, partly because they don't cost that much. You know, these, you don't spend $300 million on an Evil Dead movie. One of the things I had an issue with in the theaters, which I accepted better this time watching it because I knew what to expect, is the original Evil Dead movies. What made them so disturbing is they were just normal, everyday people who got caught up in these insane demonic events. They were like good, clean cut, all American kids. This is a troubled family. You know, they're fighting and they're edgy and they're dealing with divorce and a bunch of real world stuff. And so when bad things happen to a family like that, even though it feels a little more realistic, you can almost in the back of your mind go, well, at least I didn't do that, so I didn't taunt the demons. You know, the original Evil Dead movies, it's just these kids who stumble upon it, and otherwise they're normal people. And that seems more terrifying because they really aren't inviting this stuff into their lives. But the other thing is with this one is, you know, when they find the Necronomicon, and they open it up, start reading it, it has as many warning signs as possible. And it kind of is a little bit of a throwback to the Evil Dead movie they made about 10 years ago, where it's like, do not read this book. And they're like, we're going to read it anyways. So it's the despair and the hopelessness of Evil Dead is in there. There's a couple nods to Sam Raimi and his Splatterfest Three Stooges homages, but it's not that. It's a grisly Evil Dead movie. And it looks, honestly, it looks better on 4K at home than it did in the theaters, because at the theaters, you're at the whim of however they're projecting it. And it is a murky movie. It is a darker movie. There's a lot of scenes that are shot in shadow that on the home screen looks good. But in the theater, they kind of look crappy. And that's one of the things that we're running into with theatrical projection. Whereas at home, you have much more control over. So it looks good. The disappointing thing about this is there's nothing on the DVD or Blu-ray. Is there's nothing on the 4K or the Blu-ray. There's no other special features. It's just the movie, which I wish they weren't doing this. I heard more and more about them just doing bare bones releases, and I wish they wouldn't. I like having the special features. I like having the additional features. I talked about The Pope's Exorcist a couple weeks ago. That had extra features. This one does not, so you do just get the movie. Now, if you're going to get it, get the physical media, because the physical media you will always have, and people get residuals based on that. And that's what the whole writer strike's about. So if you're going to buy new movies, buy the physical media. Don't just buy the streaming version, because most physical media comes with a streaming link. But still, I'm going to have to say I enjoyed Evil Dead Rise. I actually think I liked it better the second time in watching it at home. So I'm going to have to say Evil Dead Rise totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
And that's it for this show. I got to go. Next week when I come back, I'm going to be talking about Barbieheimer. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.